Welcome to The Created Life. Each week, The Created Life podcast offers insightful, inspiring interviews with entrepreneurs, creatives, and people just like you about being empowered, living with vitality, and creating positive change in the world through creative action. The Created Life covers a wide range of topics relating to personal growth, adventure, inspiration, business, social impact, fitness, and health. My name is Damian Taggart. I'm a serial social impact entrepreneur, and I'll be your host on this journey. Thanks for joining me for this episode of The Created Life. Welcome back to The Created Life. On today's episode, I speak with a wise and compassionate human, Aaron Karunda. Aaron is a native Ugandan social impact entrepreneur that I met while traveling in Uganda last October. Aaron and I spent an afternoon hiking through remote villages in southern Uganda near Lake Bunyoni. A couple weeks ago, I caught up with Aaron to record this interview, and on today's show, Aaron shares his inspiring story of overcoming many obstacles to achieve success despite the odds. He is founder and CEO of Njuba, a business that empowers community through literacy. I want to point out that around 15 minutes into the interview, I ask Aaron about growing up with privilege in a developing country. I am mistakenly assumed that Aaron must have come from the small upper class of Ugandan society because he is so well educated and has achieved so much, but this couldn't be further from the truth, as you'll hear from Aaron's inspiring story of overcoming extreme poverty, accepting responsibility to be a leader for his community and country, and rising to the challenge of making a difference and staying positive in the face of major social problems. Aaron paints a picture of life in Ugandan society and talks about what it's like growing up under the dictatorship of Yoweri Museveni. My conversation with Aaron really brought home for me the importance of embracing our power to help those who are left behind. I hope you enjoy the show.
Well, I really appreciate you making time for this. It's at the end of your workday. So why don't we start with talking about your work with Njuba? That's still your main project, right?
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, why don't we talk about Njuba a little bit? So you want to tell us about just kind of the origin of Njuba and kind of what Njuba is doing these days?
All right. So Njuba started out as a social enterprise, and we basically wanted to be able to help and make a difference while also being sustainable. All businesses were focused on the one bottom line, making profit. And we thought business can be done differently. We can actually do good business and be able to also do well and help the communities where we're working. And they are focusing on a triple bottom line, which is people, planet, and profits. And so when we started out, we were making clothing. So we made t-shirts and made skirts and made jewelry and made accessories like bags and sold them on our website to mostly a market in the US and in Singapore. And that went on well. We had some people in those countries that were helping to kind of get this going. And after some time, we did an evaluation with some help from business school students. And we advised that the best way would probably be to build the products from Uganda and then be able to expand globally. So we moved back and scaled here. And then after a year, we realized that probably the best way forward was to help and empower our artisans who were making these products to be able to build their own personal businesses rather than depend on us for design and marketing and everything else to make that happen. So then we focused on that, helped them develop business plans, and started to help them with credits that would help them to build their own businesses. And many of them right now run their own businesses successfully. They can support themselves and their families, and that continues to go on that way.
Cool.
Fast forward in 2012, we then realized that, well, we're living in a country that had more than 50% of its population as children below the age of 15. And most of them were dropping out of school. And we thought, well, we always want to create impact where we can make the most impact. And we've done this with artisans. And now maybe we should venture into education and be able to make impact at scale. So we started to find a way that we would get into education in a non-conventional way. Because everybody was getting to education at the time was basically either trying to get into schools, building schools, or getting into teaching, or doing the conventional educational things that everybody did. And we thought, how do we bring fun and excitement to kids and teachers and parents, at the same time, help them to develop skills and be able to help them to develop their literacy? And of all the things we thought about at the time, it seemed like doing a spelling bee was the one thing that would bring everything together. So in the spelling bee, we would be able to excite the kids and excite the parents and their teachers, but also help infuse several skills in there and several things that would make it much more beneficial to the children. And when we thought about that, we decided to develop our own version of the spelling bee. So there are spelling bees all over the world that mostly copy what the American spelling bee or the Scripps spelling bee does, and they just replicate that. And we thought, well, we're in Uganda, we're solving a completely different problem than just a spelling game. Mm-hmm. Can we use this as a tool to be able to address what we want to address? And we started from scratch and rebuilt a spelling bee that would be able to be value-based. So through the spelling bee, the words that the children get to spell and the words they get exposed to, those words are from the values of character, responsibility, excellence, empathy, and discipline. So while they learn those words, they are also developing these values and this value system in them that will be helpful as they grow up when they start to make these decisions on their own. Then we also thought this spelling bee should focus on positive words, and positive words because we realize words change the world. Mm. Well, there are two ways to change the world. There is the gun, and then there is the pen. And those who choose the gun are influenced by those who write. And those who write, write words. So our conclusion is that words change the world. So we thought, what better way is to focus on specific words that would help influence these children as they grow up and form attitudes and become adults? And we thought, well, there is a lot of negativity around the world and people love to complain and talk about how things are not working. Can we focus on positive words that help to build a positive attitude among these children and help them to grow up with that positive attitude? So we put together a list of only positive words and expose children to positive words so they can grow up thinking positively and have those words affect them and their attitudes. And the third thing we thought, the spelling bees all over the world focus on the individual child. And yeah, at that age, we love to celebrate the individual child who has made it and got all the help from everywhere to kind of make it happen. However, in life, we really work as a team. We work together with other people. And we thought, what better way would it be to help these children from childhood to learn the value of teamwork and be able to prepare together as a team and go into the competition knowing that if I'm a star speller, I have helped my friend to be able to come up to the same level as me so we can be able to win. And we had scenarios where these children would come in the competition and the star speller didn't do anything to help their colleagues and she would emerge as the best speller overall, but the team would not qualify for the next level. And it would sound absurd, but then the lesson that all those children learn at that stage stay with them. And eventually, we started to see these children working together and trying to help each other so much that they would win as a team or lose as a team. That started to work in like amazing ways, and now it's a standard. So we created a spelling bee in that way that would be able to help kind of build things and help children to become better.
Yeah,
so we also realize that in addition to those things, the art of standing up on stage and facing several people and being able to ask questions like, what's the meaning of that word? Or can you use it in a sentence? Or what is the etymology of the word? Helps these children to develop not just presentation skills, but also critical thinking. And this is in a culture where questioning and asking questions is not something that we pride ourselves in.
Mm.
And especially for children, children like really never ask questions to their adults or to teachers. But the spelling
behind. Why is that, do you think? Why is it that way in your culture?
It's a culture of, I think, respect.
Mm.
So it is, and there have been proverbs that have been said that you never look the elder in the mouth, which is basically you never respond to the elder when they are talking to you. And you also never question them, because questioning them is like saying that what they are saying may not be true.
I see.
And the elder is king, is ultimate. And so the same thing happens in schools. The teacher is on top and the children just have to listen, even if what the teacher is teaching is wrong. And personally, I went through experiences where I would ask a question in class and instead of teacher responding, they would send me out of class and discipline me for asking a question. So it's a culture where asking questions is not a big thing. Asking questions is very critical for brain development and for just personal development of everyone, and helps us to gain more knowledge. So the spelling bee is helping these children in schools to get comfortable with their teachers and be able to ask questions. And ask simple questions that then graduate into having a conversation and having the freedom to engage with these teachers, which is great. And we are seeing now that the participants in the spelling bee were able to ask questions and are curious enough to want to seek more knowledge, are performing better in standardized tests and exams, and are going on to finish primary school and go to secondary school, which is really what we wanted to see happen. At the same time, while we're doing the spelling bees, of course, when we realize that our teachers who were depending on to work with to make this go across our old schools and being ingrained in the culture of teaching, were not up to speed as we expected. And then we started wondering why that was so. We visited a few teacher training colleges and discovered that these teachers were not being helped to mature enough to be able to be prepared enough to teach the nation. So we started a teacher training program as we learned and got feedback from these teachers and from parents and from learners. So we started a teacher training program to help prepare these teachers and equip them with the tools and skills they need to be effective in their classrooms, but also to help them with personal growth and just help them to be aware about who they are and the potentials they have within them. And to date, we've been able to train about 10,000 teachers and help them to become STAR teachers. Most of them have gotten promotions in their schools or have moved to better schools with better pay. And their expression and ability to teach has become much better than it was before.
That's amazing. And can you tell people, are most of these schools rural, or is it a good mix of urban and also rural? What can you tell us a little bit, like what these schools you're talking about are like, so that people can have a sense of what schools in Uganda are like?
So most of the schools we work with are a mix of urban and rural. In this case, urban would be Kampala. They mix, but the rural schools, which are also mostly public schools or government-aided schools, make up about 90% of all the schools we work with. And we are working with about 1,500 schools across the country. And a government-aided school basically has pretty much about one or two blocks with classes or rooms, about 7 or 8 or 10 rooms. And each room or class would have students of about 80 to 400.
Hmm.
And sometimes 400 is like a high number, and they would have no desks. They would sit on the floor. They would be crammed in this room, and teacher would have no space to basically sit. Sometimes the teacher stands in the doorway to be able to address and teach the classes, the students in this class. In most of these classes, the teacher, if there's some room, they'd stand on the blackboard where they would write and instruct from. And they would be standing all the time in one place, and most of the kids would be seated down and looking at the teacher and basically taking in whatever the teacher says. So that's how the schools kind of look like. They are dotted all over the country in rural places. Most of the kids go to these schools barefoot, with some have uniforms, some don't have uniforms, some have torn uniforms, some have no books at all to write in. And they expect it to go and learn, because now the government is pushing for more children to go to school. And so parents are sending children to school regardless of whatever condition they're in.
So, and you said that it's 50% of Ugandans are under 15. Is that right? Is that the statistic?
52%.
Okay, 52? Yeah.
Yes, 52%.
So, and there's about 40 million people in Uganda?
Yeah, 40 million people in the country.
So
yeah.
You've got like 20 million kids under 15. And then
exactly.
And the literacy rates are, what are the literacy rates for children?
So the literacy rates, according to World Bank and the normal standing, is about 67%.
Mm.
But that is the ability to write your name.
I see.
That's the definition of literacy. However, in primary school, which has about 10 million of those 20 million kids, the reading ability is just about 3 out of every 4 kids can read and understand what they are reading.
Hmm. Okay.
So it is pretty low in primary schools. Some kids seem to be reading, but they can't understand what they are reading, and some of them can't read at all.
Totally. So that's great. I really love the work that you guys are doing. The idea of words change the world is really great. I think it's, you know, it's true how our words inform what we believe, and then what we believe turns into action, and then that ends up being the impact that we have. That's really cool. So can we talk a little bit more about how, or can you tell me a little bit more about how you got, like kind of what your personal story was, how you grew up, and just what your trajectory was like, and how you got to be, how you got such a good education that you clearly, you know, you're clearly a well-educated person. And I guess like what I'm asking is, growing up with privilege in a developing country and sort of what that's like.
Okay. So I didn't grow up with privilege.
No. Okay. Okay.
I grew up in rural Uganda experiencing, abject poverty, where I basically, if I wore one shirt, I didn't wear pants. And I was definitely barefoot all the way from 0 to about 12 years. Never wore shoes. Didn't even know what that meant.
Okay, so totally different.
I was growing up in a family where, where we basically had a meal a day. And sometimes that meal was cassava with salt. I walked to school about 3 kilometers to school, and I had fun really growing up. My parents kind of tried to cover the poverty we were going through from us, the children. So we never really understood what being poor meant or what we're going through, because anyways, all our neighbors were going through the same exact things we're going through. So there was no difference. I remember part of my hobbies was in spare time, I would go and stand by the road and count the cars that were passing and say, that is mine. And there would be like maybe 10 cars in a day that would pass on that road.
Hmm.
But as a child, I think the biggest thing that made a difference was growing up with a mother who had gone to school a little bit. My mother had gone to school and dropped out at a certain stage after about 9 classes. And she knew the value of education. So while we were children and while we were still kids, she would read for us the Bible every evening after dinner and tell us Bible stories. It was the only book that we had at home. And she would read that over a kerosene lamp, which would be dim, but we were very eager to hear what she was reading and what was going on. And at about age 8, I was curious to read this book for myself. So I would get and start to kind of read it for myself. And at 9, I went through one of the traditions in the Anglican church, which is confirmation, where you have to have read the 10 commandments and be able to recite them. So I had read the 10 commandments for myself. I could be able to recite them, and so I was confirmed at 9, when normally I should have been confirmed at 12. Mm. And my mother kept saying and telling us that the only investment and the only inheritance she was going to leave for us was an education and nothing else, because she had nothing else to leave for us. And then as I went on, I how many of the other kids were dropping out of school, but it wasn't a big deal. It was later when I got to university that I realized that I was pretty much the only one from my primary school who was at university. Hmm. And that was a time when every student was kind of joining in their old students association. So kind of coming together with students from their former schools to form an association and kind of have a belonging, and I had none. And I looked back and I wondered what happened to the kids I went to school with. That's when I started to kind of investigate what happened to them. And I realized, as I went back to my village, I realized some of them had dropped out of school and were married with 3 wives and having multiple children and were completely drunk. Mm. And their life was completely different. And I looked at what was different. We were attending the same school, same teachers. What was different between me and them? And I thought the difference was maybe my mother and kind of the kind of environment that my parents created for us and encouraging us to go to school and to go higher. Because the other thing I keep remembering is my parents kept telling us that if anyone else can be anything, we too can. Hmm. So they pushed us harder to be able to be the best we can ever be.
Wow, so you really were pretty exceptional then in terms of the way that you, it seems like that value system that your mother imparted in you, that you can be anything you want to be, that's not a common, is that a common idea in Uganda, or is it?
No, it's not a common idea. It's not a common idea, but I think she had gotten some exposure and she knew that sometimes money can limit you, but if there is a chance, you can be anything you want to be and you can keep going and becoming a better person. And she kept, right now, she reads. Every time I go to the village, she's asking me for a new book so she can read. She keeps educating herself so she can be a better person, so she can be exposed to the world and be able to know different places. If I come back from a travel, say in the US, and I come and tell her about these places I've been, she's like, yeah, I read about that place. How is it like? So I can actually have a conversation with her about anywhere in the world because she has read and taught herself. And it's pretty exceptional for her, given her level of education. Being able to read and encourage and push us to be anything we want to be.
Mm. Yeah. That's really amazing. I bet she must be really proud of you and the success that you've come to. That's really great. And before
yeah, she did.
Before you started the Spelling Bee and got into Njuba. You did a lot of work with radio, isn't that right?
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that experience and kind of what you were doing with radio?
Okay, so to just kind of bridge, so I go through school and I didn't go through the best schools, but I kept thinking I can make it and I can be better. And at the end of my A-levels, which is kind of the equivalent of high school in the US, I got good enough grades to get a government scholarship to go to university. That's how I end up being at university. And while I'm at university, I have been awakened that I'm the only one from my school that made it to university. And now I have a consciousness to want to make a difference, to help those who didn't make it or their children. And I actually start kind of working on something that led to the creation of Njuba early on in middle, I finished university. But Njuba was so small that I kept seeking other ways to be able to be helpful that could also kind of give me an income as a young, fresh graduate. And I did some consultancies in development communication, helping break down complex messages for the general population to be able to understand. And that's how I also got into radio. And when I got into radio, my vision and my desire was to be able to provide information that would enable the listeners to make the most important decisions of their lives. So worked at two radio stations, and both radio stations I was kind of in charge, helped set them up, and created the programming. And all the programming was focused on helping the listeners to make the most important decisions of their lives. So we made our programming in such a way that would provide the most relevant information that they needed. And at one of such a radio station, which was based in rural Uganda, this community, many people had given up on work. They had given up on hope, and they just pitied themselves. And so we started to think, how do we create programs that reinvigorate them and give them hope and make them realize that they can transform their own lives and become better and be set on a trajectory for success? And so I did that with my team at the radio station, who had zero radio experience and were mostly 12-year school dropouts that I had to train from scratch on how to handle technical equipment, to how to run a program and talk on radio and be able to deliver a message that can make an impact to the communities where, after we started the radio, we basically had an event every month in a new community, talking to them about values, talking to them about integrity, talking to them about the resources they have in their community and how they can use those resources to make a difference for themselves and get themselves out of poverty. And I think the most shocking thing to me, I was 25 years old at the time, was how simple ideas that we shared with the community on radio and through community events transformed these communities, how they took all the simple ideas so serious, acted on them, and they transformed themselves, formed groups, worked together, were able to harness all the resources they had and became a better people.
That's great. What's an example of that?
So an example of that was a community that thought, well, we are here and we have land. Why don't we come together and plant coffee on our land so we can be able to harvest a lot more coffee at the same time as a cooperative society, be able to sell it and make more money for ourselves? Another example was another community that came together and thought, well, we can complain about the poverty we have, but how about we start saving small amounts of money each every week so we can accumulate that money and start a chicken farm? And then once those were in place, I would see other community members who were better off coming and saying, wait, if you're going to do a chicken farm, I am going to give you 10 birds of chicken. Or another one coming up and saying, if you're going to do farming and you're going to grow plantain, I am going to give you all the plantain suckers for free that could go on like 10 acres of land. And I'm thinking, how is this happening? Like, he would normally be selling that. He would normally be selling seedlings for coffee, but he was giving them for free to these communities to help them be able to develop themselves and continue. And I also saw another community after they came together and formed this cooperative society. They were able to realize that the government had some funding and support that they could apply for as a cooperative that would help them to be able to better themselves. That initially they were just individuals who thought, well, what can we do? Mm-hmm. And now they had come together as part of a fan club for a radio we had started. And they thought, now as a fan club of this place, we have a unifying factor. We have a radio that can communicate and send our messages to each other. We are going to develop ourselves and make a difference in our own lives. And beyond that, even for individuals, I saw individuals, there is a guy, he had a hairdressing salon and he had basically stopped working and given up. And one day he's listening to a morning show and there is this message encouraging him to kind of use what he has to start his business. And he decides to go back and reopen his salon and make business. And he's still doing that. So simple things like that, that kind of just pumped energy and hope into these community members that made them to kind of go on to live a better life.
That's amazing. Yeah, I love that. I mean, it's really great to see somebody who's being able to harness, even primitive, relatively primitive communication technology like radio to really make a huge difference and to empower people. So that's really great. And then so in Juba, within Juba, you formed a for-profit social impact company and you started the Spelling Bee, and then you're also doing publishing. Is that right? Still publishing children's books?
Yes. So initially we ran a for-profit company, which was basically a clothing company. Mm-hmm. And when we got into education, we thought, well, we may not be able to make profit in this area, but let's strive to be sustainable as an organization so we can try to pay for our own costs and be able to make as much difference as we can. So after starting a spelling bee and running it and doing teacher trainings, we also realized that while we're encouraging children to read and telling teachers to encourage children to read, there were no books or materials that they could read. So we decided to start a publishing arm to be able to publish locally relevant children's books that would help children to fall in love with reading. And now we know, now that we've been doing this, we see the difference. The children before get a book that was mostly gray, black and white, and they would open it and it wasn't attractive at all and they would put it right back and would never read. And that was affecting them from childhood and to adulthood. So we have a very bad reading culture in the country like Uganda. And so when we introduced picture books where children can, even if they don't know how to read, they can just read, look at the pictures and be able to interpret the pictures, we've seen that having a huge impact on them. We've seen, for example, several 3-year-olds or 7-year-old kids who can't read, being able to get one of our books and being able to tell each other a story of what is going on by looking at the pictures and being able to interpret that and enjoy the book and flip through it to the end, given the attention span of kids. Being able to flip through a 32-page book, it really makes a difference. And we see that those kids' life will never be the same again as they start to do that and now start to want to know what these words actually say. Mm-hmm. What is this story actually about? And we are seeing that taking root and we're seeing many, many more kids and parents and schools wanting to get these books so that children can read.
And so your books are some of the first like Ugandan children's books that have full color pictures and are really telling Ugandan stories. And so prior to that, were the kids mostly getting like children's stories from other cultures, from the US or from Europe or something like that?
Okay. Yeah, so prior to that, the schools that could afford children's stories would get them from UK or from the US. Either they would buy them or they would have those books imported here that would end up in like high-end schools. Mm-hmm. Or they would have books mobilized through like book drives in the US, put on a container and sent here. That in some of those books would be like discarded books or very old books that are no longer being used in the US. And then they would have access to those that would make also a different kind of understanding for these children as they would look at the books. They can't see themselves in the books. So for example, a parent actually shared with me one day about her daughter who was reading this book from one of the Disney series. And so this character who had long hair, and she asked her dad, why would I have long hair? And the dad basically had no response because was a hair texture is different from a hair texture in American culture. So
sure.
These books are making that kind of difference and helping parents to answer questions or not have to answer such questions.
So what is the most like helpful thing that you think people in developed countries like the US could do if they want to be helpful for growth and positive change in a place like Uganda?
I think there are a number of things. I'll be biased, but I think it's foundational. I think that one of the best things that can be done for someone in a developed country to help a country like Uganda is invest in education. And the reason I say that is because there are two kinds of sayings. One saying says that if you want to if you want to feed someone for a day, give them a fish. But if you want to feed them for a year, give them a hook.
Right, yeah.
If you want to feed them for generations, teach them how to fish.
Totally.
They'll figure out the hook. And so I think that if anyone who wants to help invested in education and helped the millions of children in this country and several other developing countries to get real education, quality education, then they can be able to figure out their politics. Because once more and more people are educated, they have access to information, they can be able to say, look, this guy is lying to us. We don't want him in power. We'll vote him out.
Mm-hmm.
Education can fuel democracy in the best way possible. Because once people have access to information, can read for themselves, they can't be confused. In Uganda, we have probably over 200 radio stations. Most of these radio stations focus on entertainment, not education, because even the people who are working on the radio stations would rather just do entertainment because they can't read for themselves or research and provide relevant information to the people so they can make decisions. So you go to a community and they've heard something from the radio but is inaccurate. And so they can't even make a decision that's political or health or otherwise based on the information they have from the radio station. But if these communities are educated, then they are exposed and that helps them to want a better life and to want to go beyond what they have been used to or tied to for generations.
Cool. And so you
of my own life.
Right. And so you've basically lived almost your entire life under Museveni. Is that correct? President Museveni?
Yes.
I guess
yes.
He was elected maybe when you were 1 year old or something like that. Is that right?
He was not elected.
He was not elected.
He took over power. He used a gun He used violence and took over power in 1986 when I was, probably about six months old. And he got into power, and for the first 10 years, he kind of set up a broad-based government and told the whole nation how he's the best president ever, inside organizing elections that were first based on his party. And then after pressure from the international world, he kind of opened up political parties to be set up, but they really don't have much freedom to express themselves and go out and hold rallies like his party can.
Right. So, and he's pretty old now. He's in his 70s. Is that right?
Yeah, his right age is not exactly known.
I see.
But he says he's in his 70s.
So what does a post-Museveni Uganda look like? Because he can't stay there forever. So what's your sense of what's going to happen when Museveni finally passes?
Well, many things. It depends on how that happens. Mm-hmm. But let's say he passes naturally and he's gone. I think that Uganda can start to rebuild itself. I think that Museveni has done his best and probably undone some of the things he did. And a post-Museveni country is going to require a broad base of people coming together and working together to rebuild the country. The biggest issue, and probably alludes to my first response of investing in education, is a mindset issue. So during the time we've had Museveni as the president, we've also had we've had lots of institutions die, and we've had a lot of a lot of informality take on. Informality in the sense that because the institutions are not there, the president can decide to donate money or to give away money to people who should be receiving a loan from the bank, for example. So he will find a group of people and say, I love what you're doing, I'm going to give you 200 million. And he gives them 200 million in a sack, in a bag, mm-hmm. not through a wire transfer. And that has made him to be the sole solution to every problem. So if there's a wrong or in a market, people won't listen to anyone else but the president. He will have to show up, then the wrong will be solved. If there is a land wrong, people want the president to show up and solve the wrong. But because of that, it has also kind of exacerbated crime, organized crime, in a way that some people can show up in a village and say, we are from the state house and we want this land. And so people grab land in the name of state house. And that kind of informality and death of institutions has destroyed the economy and destroyed the belief in systems, and has also flamed corruption.
Sure.
And enabled people to think, if I need to get a passport, I have to bribe someone. If I need to get a national ID, I have to pay money to someone. If I need to go to hospital and be treated, I need to tip the doctor before he treats me. Yet, in normal circumstances, these professionals and this organization should be able to work on every Ugandan in a certain way without expecting to receive a pay or a tip or a bribe. Now, that has created a mindset across the country where every driver thinks they can get out with a traffic offense if they give the policeman some money. Or if everybody thinks they can pay themselves to get whatever document they want or to get whatever contract they want. That mindset will have to change. And that mindset is now amongst several Ugandans. And we'll have to change post Museveni. And it will take a lot of work and a strong government that is interested in building institutions to kind of refocus that and make it serious so that the country and the economy can get back on track.
So how do you stay positive when there's so much like corruption and there's just so many things that, need to be fixed and addressed? Like, what are some of the things that you use in your life to stay just like motivated and positive and moving forward? Because it seems like you always have just such a good energy and positive outlook regardless of what's happening, you know, in the larger context. Like, you're really focused and you're really on point. Can you talk about how you manifest that?
So the number of things that happened, I think the first thing that has really been helpful was for me to find the one thing that I love to do and the one thing that I think will have maximum impact. So I looked at the spectrum of my country and I could have gotten into politics. I could have become an activist. And I thought, of all the things that there is to do, where can I make the most impact? And where can I put my energy so that that impact can be created? And once I identified that, then I poured myself into that. And every day I wake up knowing in small ways I am making a difference towards this country. But I also got to realize that the change I seek, the change I want to see, is not going to happen overnight. And so just understanding that it's not going to happen overnight and understanding that it may happen in 20 years or it may not even happen in my lifetime, but I have to build the foundation and start the first building blocks that if I am gone, the people after me can find something to build on, has helped me to stay the course and know that I have to do my part now so that the generation after me, or when I'm 80 years old, my grandchildren won't come asking me, "Grandpa, what did you do in your time?" And I have nothing to tell them. I can be able to say, "Look, I built the foundation that you can build on to make the change we want to see in our country," than just be overwhelmed and give up and be like, "Well, there is nothing I can do, so let me do nothing." Also, the reason I didn't choose to go political or become an activist is because as an activist, you would have a sense of wanting change now. And when that change doesn't happen now, you can easily get frustrated and burnt out and give up. You can also get derailed easily and you just burn out and count your losses and go home. As a politician, I could easily be banded together with everyone. So we have a parliament, for example, that is 75% or more pro-ruling party, and then the rest are opposition. And the ruling party politicians are going to rubber stamp whatever the president wants or whatever they agree on. Even if they disagree with it, they'll just go with it because the party says we should go this direction. The others are a minority that it's just, they'll just talk and make no difference. And many of them either compromise and join the ruling party or just keep making noise for many years and people give up on them and they're like, "Well, you're just making noise, you're making no difference." So I think finding what I really wanted to do and focusing on that has been of help. But I also choose which information I take in. So I noticed that every radio station or TV station I would turn on would have a ton of bad news about something, some money being stolen, some corruption, somebody dying in a hospital because they weren't taken care of. There's so many of those things happening, and I thought, well, I am going to choose which information I can take in and feed on, so that I'm not feeding on negative information all day.
Right.
Be exposed to the media that is bombarding me with all this information all the time and just spoiling my days. I'll choose which information I take in, and I will focus on what I'm doing because it's making a difference, and I'll continue making a difference even when there is so much negativity going on and can be overwhelming and can feel like you're just a drop in the ocean.
Right.
Yeah,
that's really great. I've done the same thing in my life of just being really careful about what information I take in and just making sure that, you know, well, it's good to be informed and it's good to know what's happening in the world. It's also important to protect your psyche and to be able to be able to stay focused on what you want to create. I think that's really awesome. Who are some of your biggest influences or teachers? Like who do you take or who do you follow, I guess? Like who's influential to you?
It's a very hard question. I think there are many overall. So I tend to look at people who've made a difference in their own lifetime and their own countries. And some of these people have made a difference in different fields, politics, technology, religion, that I wonder how did they do it? And that challenges me to know that maybe I also have the same potential to make that difference. So I'll name maybe three of them. The first and foremost, and taking him as a person literally, is Jesus Christ of Nazareth. So, well, what is written about this guy is he grew up for about 30 years, and there is like nothing about him. When he was 30, he spent 3 years, got a group of 12 people, and impacted on their lives so much that 3 years was enough. And when he was gone, they have built probably the biggest movement in the world. There could be lots of controversy in that movement, but everybody in it, with the different things they agree on and disagree on, they still believe in him and never fault him for their differences.
Sure.
And I imagine, how was he able to create such a difference that has stayed on for so many generations in 3 years with 12 normal people, ordinary people? The other person that I look at is kind of very close by in this generation, but they're both dead. The other two, all the three are dead. The other person is Lee Kuan Yew. Lee Kuan Yew was the first prime minister of Singapore. And one of the first statements he made when he was just getting into that position, he said, the world does not owe us anything. So we have to create our own country and make our own living, because the world doesn't owe us a living. So we can't expect the world to feed us, to give us aid for education, to give us aid for healthcare. The next statement he said is that the people have trusted me who trusted us to lead them, we shall not betray them by being corrupt. And the country, I know that was able to move from a third world country to a first world country in 30 years. And it's also a country or his leadership that influenced a lot of Chinese revolution and the China we see today. There is a lot that they learned from what he was doing in his state that kind of influenced how China started to kind of get on that trajectory to being a big economy right now. And so looking at his life and the kind of things he did and the kind of policies he passed makes me think it is doable. Even in a short time of 30 years, it is doable. You can actually turn around an entire country in 30 years and have your people move from per capita income of less than $1,000 to per capita income of more than $30,000. No African country has been able to pull that off, even with all the resources we have. Singapore had no resource. But was leadership. The other person that kind of influences me and challenges me is Steve Jobs. You look at Steve Jobs and look at the things, his imagination to create things and create a world that is not. And he's popular saying the people don't know what they want until you show it to them. And I'm thinking, what are you made of? How do you come to imagine such things and well, obsessed with some of them so much that you can transform almost 5-6 industries in your lifetime and yet die when you're 50 something and you have made such a big difference? And I imagine what kind of person is he? What kind of drive, what kind of knowledge, what kind of skill set, what kind of motivation did he have to be able to make such a difference? Now, when I look at the kind of changes and differences these people made, it makes me think it is possible. Even the biggest, wildest dream that I can imagine, it can be done. It has been done before. And so that keeps me pushing, it keeps me inspired, it keeps me thinking, these people were humans like me. They had the same set of brain like me. They made a difference in their different sectors. I can make a difference in mine and can stay on for generations.
Yeah, I'd love that. That's great. That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. So another question that I've been asking everybody that I've interviewed is if you could just virally implant one idea and spread it to all people or one practice, what would you want to kind of give the world if you could just, you know, snap your fingers and it would be done?
If I could just implant one idea in all people and it is done, it would be kindness. The idea of kindness. Like, just be kind to yourself, be kind to everyone. It is simple, it is everywhere, but I think that if we were kind enough to each other, it would show we love each other, the world would be a much better place.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I love that. I heard recently one of my friends said, I can't remember where they heard it. Somebody said, be kinder than you need to be. And I liked that concept. Mm-hmm. Well, cool. Is there anything else that you'd want to kind of get out to a wider audience or to a Western audience, I guess? Any things that we didn't cover? Any kind of thoughts about, I don't know, just the way you want people to think about East Africa or the context of Africa currently?
Well, I would say everyone should think about Africa as 54 different countries, mm-hmm. with each country having several tribes and several different cultures. We are unique people, and everybody is different in their way, in their culture. So there is no such thing as African food, or African language, or African wear, or even African.
Sure.
Because we are different, and people are proud of their cultures more than they are proud of Africa or Africanness. And it seems that most people on the continent refer to Africanness as their skin color, mm-hmm. not as their culture or state of being. Within Africa, the continent, there are rich people, some too rich. There are poor people just like anywhere in the world. The one thing that anyone who wants to help developing countries or African countries, they should already think about what do the people that I want to help want or need, rather than this is what I think we should do for them, and then you come up with a nice proposal, a nice program, and take it to them and fails. You'll be frustrated because it will fail.
Yeah.
Because different people need different things, and some of the things they need are different from what we see they need. So for example, you may think that a group of women in a particular village need a nearby water source, and all they need is something else, not a water source. And they are happy going away from their homes and walking 1 kilometer away to be able to get social therapy and talk to each other and laugh with other women while they fetch their water. But if you brought it close to their village or within their village, they won't be able to get what they get going out, and they may never use it. So being really able to involve the people into creating their own programs that will make a difference for themselves would really be great, and would make a lot more impact than all these programs that have been created from without and being transferred and planted here.
Sure.
So the idea of duplication needs to be handled with customization, because every community, every country, every village, every people are different. Customizing good ideas to them with their input will make a huge difference than just imposing it on them.
That makes total sense. Yeah, so it's probably better for people in the West or in developed countries to be involved with local organizations and local people like yeah. in Juba and similar organizations than it is to try to just start your own initiative or how do you feel about that? I mean, what's the best way for people to find kind of good Ugandan organizations to support?
Well, I think the best way is talk to people. So if someone wanted to come to Uganda and do something in Uganda, of course they can start with an internet search of several organizations and then talk to people, ask others what they would recommend. And you would find that a number of people will know that if you want to work in this sector, there is a list of, say, 5 organizations you shouldn't miss. If you want to work in this sector, there is a list of 5 organizations you shouldn't miss. But that would come from several recommendations that would help to find the right organization and the right people to work with. And even when you find them, It is important to talk to them and engage with them and have a sense of trust that you have with them and work with them based on that sense of trust than even working with them on a sense of superiority.
Sure.
And superiority in the sense of someone may have, say, funding or money that they want to support. They want to use support an organization here or the work that organization is doing here. And sometimes money can make one think they are superior or they have more power than the people who are receiving it. And yet a relationship of trust can make a huge difference, but also enables a lot of transparency to happen. And you get in touch with the reality of what's going, what's happening, what works and what won't work, and how best to make the best impact out of everything.
Great. Well, thank you. I really have enjoyed our conversation, and I'd love to have another conversation with you. Hopefully I can see you again in person in 2020. Yeah. And get a group of people out there. It would be great. Sure. So yeah, thanks so much for your time, and I hope you enjoy your evening.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast and for sparing time to have this conversation with me.
That's all for this episode of The Creative Life. Join me next time for my interview with Theo E.J. Wilson, an African-American journalist, motivational speaker, musician, and poet who is kind of widely known for his work going undercover in the alt-right movement. Theo is a really interesting and gifted orator, and it's a great interview, so I hope you tune in for that. Until then, I wish you a week of peace and prosperity. This is Damian Taggart signing off.